Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Local author Ridley Pearson is one of the folks who makes this region proud. He has written 48 books and is a regular on the New York Times bestseller list. He writes for adults and young adults. His Peter and the Starcatcher series, co-authored with his pal, humorist Dave Barry, was adapted for the stage and won 5 Tonys on Broadway. Some of his work has also been adapted for television. Ridley's latest book is The Red Room, another thriller, the third in his latest Risk Agent series. I'm Don Marsh. How Ridley Pearson has time to do radio interviews, I don't know, but we're certainly glad you're here, Ridley. Nice to see you.
Thanks, Don. This is the fun part. Are you kidding? You got me out of my office.
You must spend an awful lot of time in your office.
Oh, my gosh.
48 novels. I mean, I'm not sure I've had 48 ideas in my lifetime. You've taken 48 of your ideas and made them into books.
It's been a lot. But, you know, it's some of those numbers were increased by the Peter and the Starcatchers and the Kingdom Keepers series because these opportunities come along and you just can't say no. I mean, Disney came along and said, you know, would you write a series of a sort of a suspense series inside our theme parks? Uh-huh. And I said, well, I'd need to get in your theme parks when they're shut. And they said, that's all right. And so, you know, who's going to say no to that?
Oh, what a great opportunity.
You can't say no.
Brings out the child in all of us.
Exactly.
Right? And that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Did you have any inkling at all that Starcatcher would make it to Broadway?
No. In fact, honestly, when Dave Barry and I agreed to write this book together, based really off of a question my daughter had asked me about how Peter had met Captain Hook. And we laughed at the table the day we decided to do this together. We thought that we would go down to Kinko's and print like 8 copies and we'd each keep 4. We just didn't think there would be any market for it. So even getting a publishing contract for it surprised us. And then having it become this international bestseller and it went on, we ended up writing 4 plus another book in the series in a trilogy. So, you know, I mean, all of it's been a surprise. And I think In a really fun way, its success is probably because it was based on such an innocent question. Mm-hmm. There was no commercial inkling in this project. It was all just to answer a question of how a boy had become Peter Pan. Yeah. So.
You know, you say you sat down at the table with Dave Barry and you laughed. I can't imagine sitting down at a table with him and not laughing.
No, those 10 years I wrote with Dave, if I'd had the money, I would have had a masseuse to come at 5 o'clock and work on my cheek muscles every night. Because when you work with Dave 5-6 times a day, you are you're beyond yourself in laughter.
Yeah, he was on the program a couple of months ago, I guess he is now, and he's just a delight to be. How did you
he's
two guys?
He's such a sweet man. We play in a rock band together,
Rock Bottom Remainders.
Rock Bottom Remainders, to raise money for literacy causes. And so we both met literally on a sound stage in Los Angeles in 1991 and became close friends through the band and then eventually co-writers together. So it's been a 22-year-long friendship that's been just terrific.
And the band is kind of phasing out, I understand?
We did. We phased out 2 years ago. This is appropriate because of this last weekend here in St. Louis, but 2 years ago we lost our creator and founder to breast cancer, a woman named Kathy Goldmark. And after that, we felt like who even wants to get up on stage without Kathy up there with us? And we had an opportunity to play in November. And we did it, and we loved it, and we knew Kathy would want us to keep playing. So we've accepted a job in March of 2015 at a book festival in Tucson. So I'm sure we'll play occasionally. I doubt like it used to be, but it's nice to – we're such close friends now that it's nice to get back together just for the friendship sake.
Sure. I'm not sure that everybody knows
nobody knows, but this is Stephen King and Dave Barry, as we mentioned – Scott Turow, Mitch Albom, Roy Blunt Jr., Greg Iles, James McBride, who won the National Book Award, Matt Groening, who created The Simpsons, it's Amy Tan. It's quite a host. I mean, I really have no business being in this group, but I'm glad I'm the bass player.
Well, no one brags about their musicianship.
That band. We basically are terrible musicians, but we're terrible musicians for good causes.
And you've raised much money.
Yeah, we've raised about $3 million over the years. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the Red Room. I know that's one reason you're here, but yeah, there's some other things I want to get into as well. I always say to authors, it's difficult to talk about novels because you don't want to give too much away. You want people to buy the book and enjoy the book.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, you probably don't want to talk about the plot too much, but the Red Room has, I hope, so I try to always put a social issue under my novels. Mm-hmm. Without, you know, without getting on a soapbox, but so that when you end the novel, there's also something you might want to go Google mm-hmm. or learn about. It isn't just, hopefully, just sort of pulp entertainment. And in the case of The Red Room, there are really two big issues in the book. One is the illegal trade of stolen art, which is mm-hmm. fascinating to me. And the other is that allegedly – the Mossad has been hunting down Iranian physicists and nuclear scientists involved with their nuclear program for perhaps as long as 5 years now. There are some 12 different scientists who have either gone missing or are known to have been executed. And, you know, there's never been a connection to the Mossad. That's all alleged. But that's fascinating ground for a novelist.
But yeah, and the Mossad is pretty good at what it does and at keeping itself invisible.
They're pretty good at covering their tracks, yeah. I will say that.
These are real world issues. And yes. The art world, that gray world that mm-hmm. You write about, we'll talk more about that. But I wondered in reading the book, if you have any concerns, we were talking about the Iran, Iran effort to build some sort of nuclear device. If you worry that events will get ahead of you, when your book comes out, a lot of these things will have been dealt with or
yes.
somehow changed and therefore changed your book.
Yes, that's true. And I'm now working on a book that I hope we'll talk about a little for next year that deals with poaching in Africa. And, of course, over the weekend, one of the great lords of elephants was killed. A 48-year-old bull elephant was killed. And Al-Shabaab killed 48 humans last night in a coastal town in Kenya where I was. I was not in that coastal town, but in Kenya. So in a way, those events, I wish that book was out this week in a way, if I'm sort of self-serving. But, I don't think any of these issues goes away. I think they change and they morph and they modify. Certainly the illegal art world isn't going away overnight and poaching isn't going to go away overnight. So hopefully, my hope, like in the poaching novel, is to bring people's awareness level up because I was not aware of this issue. And maybe they'll send $5 somewhere. And maybe you'll write your congressman about art and shouldn't we be doing something about preserving our national treasures instead of letting them be sold to, you know, drug barons in South America and things like that, which is where a lot of the art goes, or to the Middle East, mm-hmm. where there are plenty of billionaires who will pay anything for a piece of art to hang it on their dining room wall.
You know, you mentioned the loss of the elephant yesterday, that came following news that 20,000 to 30,000 elephants last year, in 1 year alone, were killed by poachers in Africa.
One every 4 hours.
The elephant population is going to disappear.
It went from 5 million 9 years ago to 150,000 this year.
You know, what makes it particularly sad, Ridley Pearson, is the fact that it was determined not too awfully long ago that elephants grieve. They grieve as human beings do. And the stories of them going to the carcasses of their dead, dead friends.
I just, got back from interviewing 20 conservationists over there, and they will tell stories about elephants going back to bones 2 years old and weeping openly as they smell those bones. Mm. No, they are sophisticated, emotional beings, and we're killing them for their teeth.
Their teeth. You mentioned before we went on the air the power of one word, how this, particularly with rhino horns, which are another
yes.
big problem.
Yes, and that's in the next year's novel as well, is that the rhino population had been staging a pretty serious comeback between 1995 and 2009. And in 2009, this shows you the power of the word, one Vietnamese government minister went on the air and attributed his cure from cancer to ingesting ground up rhino horn. And since then, if you look at a graph, the graph goes straight up in rhino poaching. The market in Vietnam has raised the price of a single rhino tusk to over $800,000. It was $2,000 maybe 7 years ago. Because everybody believed, but rhino horn is keratin. It is just what our own fingernails are. So, I mean, if you really believe that eating your fingernails is going to cure cancer, you know, I've got a bridge you might want to buy.
Most of the ivory from the elephants and the rhino horns from the rhinos, obviously, go to Asia.
Yes. Vietnam for the rhino horn, and for the elephant tusks, it's almost entirely China, where it's now carved into ornamental treasures that are bought by the exceedingly growing middle class of China.
I wonder, do you have any sense in the research that you've done so far that anything can really be done about this?
Yes, absolutely. No, we can stop it. There's no question we can stop it. That with a few of the outfits, and I'll talk to you next year about this when we hopefully talk about the new book, but there are ways right now. There are organizations that you can find on the web, and they things like the one I would recommend the most is Big Life. Every dollar you give to Big Life saves elephants. They have figured out a way to do what's called community work, and the community work is bringing these Maasai tribal communities in on the realization that every elephant that lives offers 40 jobs, and every tusk that is taken takes away 40 jobs. And when the community comes to understand that, then they will stop the poaching themselves.
What kind of jobs do they bring?
Well, they mostly bring tourist jobs, and that if you take out the elephant, you take out tourism in their area. But there are, because of the tourist jobs, you go down that service structure, as you see in America or any town, and two or three jobs at a lodge for a guide or somebody carrying baggage goes down to 20 other jobs. And when you can educate a community about that economic pyramid, and by having just six jobs over there means we're employing 25 of you, plus they hire hundreds of rangers out of the Maasai tribes. All of those guys are now middle-class Africans. Every dollar they make goes down to six other people. It's just phenomenal when you show that protecting the elephants and protecting the rhinos, the economic impact is enormous. So, for instance, Big Life, and now I'm promoting next year's book, but Big Life not only has 250 private rangers patrolling 2.5 million acres where they have flipped the percentages of executed wildlife, but they have convinced the Maasai tribes. It used to be that to prove yourself a man when you hit puberty, you would go out into the bush with a spear and come back with a lion. Well, the lions are running out. Mm-hmm. And in an ingenious idea, Big Life, which, by the way, was organized by an American photographer. Big Life has created the Maasai Olympics. And now when you become a young man hitting puberty, you enter the Maasai Olympics and you win a medal, which is more important than killing a lion. And the lion population is rebounding. So, I mean, they're very simple things, but who would have thought of that? And, you know, when we fund them, we fund the Maasai Olympics and we protect the lions.
Aren't the Maasai the very, very tall Africans? I seem to remember films in growing
they're
up
herders.
About the Maasai.
Predominantly herders and farmers and wonderful people. My gosh, I met so many Maasai on my trip. In fact, I was unable to get a photo of it because the guys wouldn't let me take a photo. But I was at one point abandoned by one of my guides and I was just literally walking through the Netherlands of the prairie in southern Kenya, and I came across a giant herd of cattle, and two of these there were two herdsmen for this entire herd, and they saw me and had no idea what some white dude was doing wandering around in their grasslands, and they came over. One guy had a spear, and it was a little contentious for a minute, and then one guy spoke some crude English. And I was able to communicate what I was doing. And we had this amazing 20-minute exchange. And at the end of it, my ride finally caught up with me, and I said, will they let me take a photograph? They wouldn't let, but I mean, where I was a remarkable place visually.
And they're all about 6'7", aren't they? I
mean, yeah, they're tall guys. Yeah.
I want to continue this part of the conversation, but I have to take a
next
a
year,
break.
Don.
Well, we'll do it sooner than that because there are one or two other things that I want to get to with regard to this situation. Ridley Pearson is my guest. We're here to talk about his book, The Red Room. Eventually, we'll get to that, really. Believe me. But we have other things to chat about as well. We'll come back and continue the conversation. Ultimately, we'd like to get you into it, so give us a call if you'd like to talk to Ridley Pearson. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. If you'd like to send us an email, do so at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you want to send a tweet, do so at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Ridley Pearson. Really, just to follow up on the discussion of a future book out in about a year on dealing with the poaching issue, you've talked about some very innovative ideas for dealing with the poaching problem in Africa. What about on the demand side?
The demand side, of course, is the big issue. There have been some really serious mistakes made in trying to curb demand. But the biggest help would be if China forbade the sale of carved ivory. When we lived there, I lived there, the first risk agent is set in Shanghai based on a year I spent in China. And any of the major jewelry stores you went into had unbelievably glorious pieces of carved ivory selling for $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a piece. And these are a huge status symbol in China. And there are people driving Lexuses and Porsches and everything else around China. The middle class is just burgeoning there. And these people want that on their, metaphorically on their mantelpiece. Yeah. And so there's a market for them. And if China said, no, there is not, no store may sell this, it would stop it overnight.
Sure, but we don't have much success and haven't had much success in convincing China to do
very
much.
No, China is in an interesting position, and we could go on for hours about this because China has bought Africa. Hmm. So there's that element to it too, and they're beginning to want to look better than they are looking in that regard. Hmm. So there is some hope that they may make that move before long. They made such a move about 8 years ago. They were one of two countries to publicly burn a pile of ivory and say, this can't happen anymore. But then they allowed it again. And if they would take that stance again, the elephant might be saved. It really might be saved.
And, of course, in China, if they want to do something,
they just do it. You bet. And no, those stores could be closed overnight. Yep.
Well, you mentioned the time that you were in Shanghai teaching there. You were there for a year, as I recall. And that is where you kind of met your heroine in this in this book. Grace Chu is the name of your character. And I saw an interview that you had done with someone in which you said that she's really a composite of all the young ladies that you met in Shanghai.
Yeah, especially five or seven of them. I left my office open and my students for the reader – for the listener – I'm always thinking of readers, but for the listener, I taught a course in creative writing in English in an all-Chinese university called Fudan, which is sort of the Harvard of China. Very bright students. They were juniors. They had never written a creative word. Mostly women. I taught 70 students, 35 one semester, 35 the next semester, and I had four men in one and two or three in the other. So it was mostly young women. And so I had office hours with those young women to come in and talk about their grades and how to improve because they'd never written creatively. It was a really uphill battle for them. But I got to – by trying to get them writing, I started them in memoir. And so I came home. I still have these. I came home with 300 memoirs basically of young women – growing up in China and what it's like to move into a city of 20 million and go to college. And I learned a lot in those memoirs. I mean, these are ambitious young women who are overwhelmed by the big city. They have a real drive to achieve in business, to make their families proud. They realize they're growing apart from their family. And all of this I brought to Grace Chu because Grace is this woman really caught between the old China and the new China. She's connected to her family, but they would have wanted to see a more traditional relationship than she got involved in. So she ends up in Hong Kong, which nationalists really look down upon. And she's in China working as a private contractor in forensics accounting for a big risk-taking private security firm, which is where she meets John Knox, and the two of them work for this firm. So she's really built on these young women I met.
You know, I'd also read that creating a certain kind of tension between characters like this, Grace Chu and John Knox, somehow seemed a real challenge for you, that there were rewrites and rewrites in order to make that work.
Well, the real thing that the Risk Agent series, the conflict for me in writing the Risk Agent series was that my editor, Christine Pepe at Putnam, after reading the Grace Chu character, and she was in my early drafts of the Risk Agent, she was more a Watson to John Knox, John Knox's Sherlock. And I had her at maybe 40-50% of Knox. And Chris read her and said, you know, this is a special character. And would you consider putting two equal protagonists in the novel? Well, you just don't do that. There's always a hero. And I said, well, you know, I'm not sure any book's been written that way. And so we went through and still go through multiple drafts in these books to balance the importance, if you will, the emotional significance to the reader of John Knox, who's kind of this crude but sensitive guy, and Grace Chu, who's a very intelligent but somewhat emotionless woman. And it isn't really – they have a wonderful relationship. It's platonic. But it's they challenge each other a lot. But it was – the challenge for me was to – what would happen is Chris would say, bring up Grace a little. And I would get totally into Grace. She said, now you've buried Knox. So then I would bring up Knox a little. And in The Choke Point, the book before Red Room, the new one, I had to go 9 drafts. I wrote about 6,000 pages to get that balance accurate. For the Red Room, it was more like 5 or 6 drafts. So I think I'm learning the technique of balancing these two characters. But I hope it's as fun for readers as it is for me, because you can get attached to Knox or Grace or both of them, but neither is a lesser character.
Is it difficult? You've written 48 books. You've had many, many bestsellers. Is it difficult for you to have someone who's an outsider in a sense? I know it's the editor and I know the role that they play, kind of telling you what to do?
No, it's an accepted part of my writing. No one would want to read my first drafts. I write them long. I write them bulky. And I need an editor to come along and say, this is juicy, that's juicy, this is a great relationship, that's great dialogue. This part I don't know about. Maybe either we'll want to work on it or just lose it. I'm a collaborative guy. I always have been. I came out of the music world. I played sort of James Taylor-ish rock and roll for maybe Eagles kind of rock and roll for about 10 years before I became a published author. So I was used to having many band members tell me what was right and wrong about my songs.
How is the process now different than it was for that first novel?
In The Risk Agent?
No, the first, your first, very first novel.
Oh, my gosh. Well, the first novel, of course, you have no help. Yeah. And that's why you don't get published, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. So I had an agent who took me under his wing, and we did multiple rewrites. And then I had a really understanding first editor, a guy named Brian DeFior, who runs his own agency now. He became a book agent. But Brian, my first conversation with a big editor at a hardcover publishing firm, Brian said, you know, I love the book. I had turned it in. I love the book. The only problem is the premise and the ending. So I had to start the book all over, and I wrote 4 full drafts for him with a whole new premise and a 100-page ending that was different. Basically, I rewrote the whole book 4 times in order to get published. But, you know, I was very grateful I got published.
This is mind-boggling to me. You've had 48 books published, and you're talking about all these drafts. I mean, it seems like—
That's how it started.
But 48 times how many drafts?
Oh, I threw out, which I now regret, when I moved from Kirkwood to Town & Country, I threw out 80,000 pages of drafts. 80,000 pages. Mm. And I recycled them all. And about 3 years later, I went, why on earth did I do that? But they literally, they occupied two full storage bins that I was paying a couple hundred bucks a month for. And I thought, why am I doing this? Now I wish I had all those back. But I mean, thousands, tens of thousands of pages of drafts.
How much time do you spend each day writing? I assume you write every day.
Yeah, I'm in my office from, maybe 8 o'clock till 4 o'clock. So 8-9 hours a day.
That's a long haul.
Yeah, and I do about 4 hours on the suspense novels. I have a quick 15-minute lunch at the kitchen table, come in, and I work on the young adult stuff all afternoon. Mm-hmm. I'm really blessed to have two terrific sort of office manager assistants, Jen Wood here locally, and a woman named Nancy Zastrow, who remains behind in Idaho from all those years ago. She's worked for me for 20 years. But thankfully, they can take sort of the business side of it off my plate and let me just be creative. And that's a real blessing.
We had Sue Grafton in maybe a year ago.
Oh, she's a delightful
isn't she,
woman.
Yeah, isn't she great? Gosh, and I love her. I love her character, Kinsey Malone. But Milhone. But she said the same thing, that she wouldn't be able to do anything if she didn't have people surrounding her who took the burden of all this other stuff away.
I'm just so blessed and lucky. And I've got a number of young people working with me now on the Kingdom Keepers series, sort of keeping my life organized and the social media organized, which Jen Wood oversees. And, you know, all of that allows me to do my work. So it's great.
I want to get back to the Young People series because of a conversation we had earlier. But but I want to stay with John Knox for a minute and the art world that he was in as part of your plot for The Red Room. You bring something to the forefront that most of us don't think about. And you mentioned it earlier, and that's the illicit, illegal art world. What is that like?
Well, what interested me, Don, was that and I guess I'm just naive on this, or maybe your listeners are too, but I would never have placed stolen art and the commerce of stolen art in terms of dollar value second only to drugs. Hmm. I would have put prostitution and gambling and a million things in there before I would have put stolen art. Hmm. But it's in the billions every year. I just wouldn't. And what is astounding about that is the conviction rate is less than 5%.
Really?
Because there's only like 6 FBI agents who deal in this. There's maybe 6 or 10 Interpol agents. Same in England. There's 6 to 10. It's viewed as a white collar victimless crime. And there are plenty of victim crimes that require our law enforcement, you know, their energy and attention and their budgets. And so many of these don't get even investigated. They'll be investigated for 48 hours. I was interviewed by a guy in Texas last week for the Red Room. And he had just completed, I think, a 4 or 5 month investigation with a partner for a newspaper down there. And because 3 major pieces of art had been stolen, and when they spoke to the police about it, the police investigated it for 48 hours. Mm. And then they had to move on. You know, there were people getting shot. So this guy picked up the mantle and chased down the leads. Well, they caught the guy. They found the guy. They found the art. And they went and sat down for their piece with the guy who had stolen the art and said, we know you stole that art. And 24 hours later, the art showed up at a police precinct.
And as a rule, the people who buy this art are not publicizing it. They're not
putting it on display
anyplace.
That's it. Well, they put it on display in their own dining room.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And they might be a drug lord in Brazil or a very wealthy oil tycoon in Abu Dhabi. And there's an insignificant Picasso on their wall, but they paid $30 million for it.
You know, when I think of stolen art, I think of the Nazis.
Yes.
And I've been thinking of that more recently, as I'll bet you have, with regard to this find in, I guess it was Munich, several months ago, in which they found all of these valuable pieces that they're assuming, and they still don't know.
They still don't know.
We haven't heard much about it, that it was from the Nazi era.
Right, and you don't hear about it. And another thing that you will read about occasionally, but is happening at a far higher level than we're reading about, is the repatriation of cultural items. Because a lot of this art theft, and that's what's at the center of the Red Room, is an ancient piece called the Harmodius, which has disappeared over the millennia. It was back in the Greek days. But when we conquer each other, we tend to steal art, as the Nazis did. And then countries resent it. And thankfully, we are reaching a point in civilization where we are now willing to admit that was basically wrong of us to take an obelisk from, you know, Egypt and say, yeah, we're going to put that on a ship and take it home. And now we're beginning as countries to agree to kind of like a prisoner swap of we'll give you these three marble statues if you'll give us back. And there's a lot of this going on at the State Department level. But that's also a large part of this aftermarket of, you know, you go into Iraq, the U.S. goes into Iraq. Well, what was the first thing hit? The banks and the museums.
Yeah.
And they were just looted. And now all that stuff is being sold around the world. And only now and then do we intercept it and recover a piece.
What specifically triggered your interest in this to make it a part of the Red Room?
Well, you know, I've wanted to write an art thriller for 20 years. My cousin, Dodge Thompson, is the chief of exhibitions at the National Gallery in Washington. He has like the coolest job in the world. He travels around the world, meets the head of state or Princess Diana, and ends up in the, you know, hidden catacombs under the Kremlin, looking at art no one's seen for 50 years and makes a show out of it. And he and I have discussed forever the idea of me writing an art thriller. And when you mention art thriller to a publisher, they start snoring. They just won't do it.
Yeah.
And then a little book called The Da Vinci Code came along and they, maybe we want art thrillers.
Yeah.
But they're still reticent to publish art thrillers. But because The Red Room only has art as its backdrop and really the front story has much more to do with this Iranian nuclear physicist and maybe the Mossad's trying to kill him and how do Knox and Grace get out of the way and can they protect this guy? Should they protect this guy? What are the ethics involved? My publisher was thrilled about publishing it.
So. When you decide to take on something like this, do you have more sway, do you think, in convincing a publisher that you should do it because of the success that you've had?
I'd love to think so. I would guess I have zero sway. No, I mean, I think that like any, you know, a film or a TV, if you bring them a show and it doesn't resonate with them, they just don't want it. They may be dead wrong, but it's their company. And so I will bring something up with my publisher and they listen probably more because I've had a lot of success. But I'm not Stephen King. I can't go in and say, I want to write a story where a car comes alive. If I said that, Putnam would say, are you insane? But Stephen King, you know, 20 years ago can write a novel called Christine and have us all afraid to get in our car and sell 20 billion copies of the book. So, you know, there are authors at that level. I wouldn't say I'm one of them.
And it's the publishing business is a lot tougher today than it has been.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, let's get into that when we come back. Ridley Pearson is my guest today on St. Louis on the Air. We're talking about his book, The Red Room. We hope we're whetting your appetite for that. And if you want to hear more, Ridley Pearson will be appearing tomorrow night at the Barnes & Noble at the Fenton Commons on Gravois. That's at 7 o'clock tomorrow
night. Yeah, we have
so
much fun at those. I hope people will come down.
Oh, I hope they do, too. And I'm sure you'll have a good crowd. Ridley Pearson and I will be back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Ridley Pearson. I want to talk for a moment, Ridley, about the publishing business today and get your take on it. There are so many things going on. We've talked e-books. We've got Amazon and Hachette going through this whole thing. Yeah, why don't you explain? You're more knowledgeable than I on that. This is quite a controversy.
Well, it is. I mean, Amazon basically was trying to reach a deal with Hachette that would have, as I understand it, which may not be very clear, but would have diminished Hachette's take per book. And Hachette finally just reached that point of, you know, basically no return in profitability and said, no, you know, we're not going to give you that cut. And Amazon said, okay, then we're not going to sell your books. So one of the biggest online retailers, if not the biggest online retailer, has effectively blocked a lot of my friends' books from being sold on Amazon. And it almost to me, and I'm sure it isn't technically, but idealistically, it's almost freedom of the press to me. It's like you can't allow a giant almost a monopoly in that regard to say, we're not going to do this unless you do it our way. But I guess that's free market. But they did basically the same thing happened when Apple cut a deal to finally benefit the author in the sale of ebooks, and Amazon took them to court. And darned if the United States government didn't side on Amazon's side, which just floored me, because what Apple and a few other ebook retailers were doing were finding a way to finally help the authors gain a slightly better advance. It isn't even an advance. It's a royalty on ebook sales, where we now get less than a paperback book. And they're sold at the same time as a hardcover. So tomorrow, the Red Room goes on sale. And over 45% of my sales will be ebooks. But I will be paid at a rate as if it was a paperback book, which means the publisher and I lose about 66% of that 45% of our pay. So my pay every year has gone down.
That's astounding. And we read and hear that the big box bookstores, Barnes & Noble, you'll be there tomorrow night, that they're fighting for their very lives.
Yeah, they're fragile right now.
Left Bank Books here in town has had to reduce.
Left Bank is such a good store. Mm. I encourage everybody, if you don't want to go there, buy online there. Mm. But what a great bunch of people in a terrific store. And we don't want to lose these independent bookstores. You know, it's been proven that when you take bookstores corporate, which happened to Borders. Is, you know, they can operate for years at a deficit because they're propped up by stock price and market price. And all of a sudden they go out of business and all the independents that they drove out of town are now dead. So there are no bookstores. And it's a terrible thing to allow. So I love Barnes & Noble. They're going to help me put my kids through college. But you have to support your independent bookstore.
And there's nothing like a bookstore.
Oh,
being able to meander and browse.
Yes. Yeah, it's just amazing. I mean, you know, if you want to sit in a chair in an independent bookstore and read half the book, nobody's going to stop you.
Right.
You know, in fact, they'll probably offer you coffee. Right. I mean, it's like a private library. It's just an amazing resource.
Well, we'll have to wait to see how that turns out, but you have to be somewhat pessimistic.
It's a scary business. It's too bad that I'm in it because it's a scary business right now.
Yeah, it sure
and
is.
We need books. We need the printed word. I mean, we really do.
How do you feel about picking up a Kindle, for
lack
of a better word,
and reading a book that way? Except that it costs me money.
Yeah, well,
I still own them. You know, I think they're wonderful. I went to Kenya 3 weeks ago. I took, I don't know, 20 books with me on my iPad. You know, so, I mean, they have a place. I understand that. I think it's really good to save the trees. I'm a tree climber. Mm-hmm. I like to recreational tree climb. I happen to love a physical, you know, real book in my hands. But I certainly use ebooks productively. I have nothing against them. And they do save resources. We grind up less trees, fewer trees. So they have a real place, but I do think we have to work out the economics of it, too.
Well, clearly. I mean, given what they've lost. Is there any number out there with regard to how many people are – what percentage of people are reading ebooks as opposed to a hard copy?
Yes. I mean, I was told just 5 or 6 years ago that if my ebook sales reached 15%, everyone would be surprised. And I am an early adapter. I'm one – like I drive a Leaf – you know, the all-electric car. I love technology when it first hits. So I usually pay more than everybody else. But so I had been, as had all your listeners now, been in on the iPod, you know, tsunami. And when publishers said, oh, this is just going to be a little – I said, wait a second. You know, tell that to the CD manufacturers because there are no more CD stores. Everything is electronic. Well, sure enough, within a number of years – my sales in digital went from 7% to like 15%. In the Walt Fleming books, they were probably 20%. The risk agent is over 40%.
Right. Now, you mentioned getting on things early. Whatever happened to the typewriter stores?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and typewriter cleaners and typewriter repairmen.
Absolutely.
They're all gone.
They're absolutely gone. Who was it? Belcher's in Webster Groves? They had a big operation there.
Well, was there? Yeah.
Just doesn't
old Royals.
Doesn't
I've got
anymore.
A Royal sitting on a table when you walk in my room.
Yeah, try buying a
but
room
I,
for
the piece of paper that welcomes you, it says welcome, was printed on a computer.
I'll be sorry. Let's talk now about your young adult readers, because there's more to it than just stories for young adults. You're getting yourself, as impassioned as you are about what's going on in Africa now with poaching, you're very concerned about what's going on in our schools, the amount of violence that's taking place, the number of kids who are being killed.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, to me, the most important issue in our country in terms of our economy is education. We have got to spend more money on education, and we have to help those who need the education get it, and we are not doing that. I mean, in this city alone, we're closing a school district that desperately needs schools, and they need better schools than they had, clearly, because they weren't educating well enough. But we can't turn our back on that. We need to pump money into education, more so than guns, more so than anything. But when we live in a country where we are now beginning to accept school shootings as the norm, we used to be terrified and we used to be very vocal if there was a shooting in Colorado and five people were killed. Now, you know, somebody in some school in Ohio will have three people dead and it makes the news for about a day. We have got to make our schools safe. And I am an advocate for gun control, so go ahead and hate me. But I really believe that the what we need to do in this country is not, since it's in the Constitution and you can fight this constitutionally, you can't stop guns. I would like to see ammunition cost $1 a bullet. Then you won't have 18-year-olds able to hoard 2,000 bullets and go into a school and start spraying them around. It would cost them $2,000. They don't have that. If you want to cut some deal out at the ranges, where if you're at a shooting range, you can get ammunition for a dime a bullet, fine. And the other thing I would like to see, and I'm trying to get kids energized about this, is clearly we aren't having the impact we want by locking school doors and putting security people in school because the killings are still happening. I would like to get the kids talking about the friends of theirs to their parents, and not in a way like I'm tattling, but teenagers don't tend to talk to their parents at all, except I need money and I'm hungry. And I want to get that conversation going because I think teenagers need to look around and say, Mom, I have no evidence of this, but I think Billy is a little off, and maybe you want to talk to Billy's parents because I heard Billy talking about how he was going to get back at everybody. These conversations are happening, and kids aren't coming forward and saying, you know, I read this on Twitter, I read this on Facebook, I really think somebody should pay attention to James. It just has to happen.
How does Ridley Pearson get the kids to do this?
Well, I'm trying to make a series of videos that I will post on various social media. Thanks to Kingdom Keepers, I have some very well-attended social media.
It's the young adult
pieces.
Series,
yes.
By the way.
And I want to shoot videos and get on there and get a little preachy. I'm trying to create something with the acronym VEST for Bulletproof Vest, which is that value-educated students talk. If you know your values and you have a good moral compass, you owe it to your community, to your friends, to yourself, that if you hear somebody talking about guns or talking about revenge, that you mention it to your parents. Value-educated students talk.
What I would be concerned about with that is once the parents know it, they're being willing to come forward with that information. And today
yes, but they don't need to go to the cops. They can just call somebody's parent and say, this may be totally wrong, but I'll tell you, as a parent, I would want to hear this, that, you know, maybe your kid is talking about things he or she shouldn't be talking about. Maybe you want to have that conversation. Maybe that will help. Something has to be done, Don. That's all I'm saying. I don't have the magic answer. I'm just trying to get a conversation going.
How many young readers do you have?
I have millions, yeah. The Kingdom Keepers is read by millions of students and kids and adults.
That's a good start.
That's a good number.
That's a good start. Yep. We only have a couple of minutes left. There was another thing I wanted to mention, Ridley, with regard to your writing and your style. And that is what you've done in all the books that I've read of yours, and I've read many of them. Your locale is a character in the story.
Absolutely.
And in The Red Room, Istanbul is a character.
And I really believe in that. I think that you need to, as the writer, you need to step back from your piece when it's done and say, now, could this story take place anywhere else? Mm-hmm. And hopefully you say no. It has to take place in Seattle. It has to take place in Sun Valley. It has to take place in Istanbul for the Red Room.
And Istanbul is such a marvelous city. I mean, think of where it is and what it is and how it is.
The only city in the world on two continents, Asia and Europe. Turkey, with neighbors of Greece, Georgia, which is part of the Soviet complex, Iran, Iraq, and Syria. How would you like those neighbors?
That's a tough neighborhood.
That's a tough country to run.
There's no doubt about that. When did you first experience Istanbul and what it has to offer?
I, in fact, had to experience Istanbul virtually because my two trips there were canceled for security reasons.
Really?
I had two different research trips planned. The first one, an American woman was kidnapped and not found again. And the second one, all the violence had broken out on the streets. The government there right now is battling its own population. And this is something I've never done. I always put myself on the ground in my books. It's just something I do. That's why we were talking about Africa earlier. I've already been over there. I'm writing the Africa book now. For the Red Room, I couldn't get there. And in a way, Don, I think it has actually helped the book because I then had to – if I can't get there, how am I going to know about it? So I read a number of novels set in Turkey and in Istanbul, among them Orhan Pamuk's Museum of Innocence, which is just an amazing novel. I have traveled extensively in the Middle East, so I knew the feel that it would have, but nothing prepared me for the glory and beauty and really contrast of cultures that a place like Istanbul, formerly Constantinople, has because of its physical location between, you know, the Asian worlds and the European worlds and what that means. You can walk down a street and pass a mosque and pass a church, as you can here in St. Louis, by the way. But the smells, the markets, the people who are so wonderful and loving. I had to spend hundreds of hours on YouTube tourist videos walking me down the streets of Istanbul to know what I was talking about.
Boy, you would never know, reading your book, you would never know that that's the way you had to.
Yeah, which I'm very grateful of. And that's what the early review said, is he must have spent a lot of time in Istanbul. And I do hope it reads that way because I did. I just happened to spend it virtually.
One of the things that came up more than once in your book is the notion that John Knox doesn't want to spend any time in a Turkish prison.
No one wants to spend time in a Turkish prison. Oh my gosh, it's medieval.
I guess many of us remember, was it Midnight Express?
Yeah.
Which is the one.
Was that a Thai prison or something?
No, I think that was.
Was that Istanbul?
I think it was. I think it was a Turkish prison.
Yeah. Anyway. No, there's nothing you want to spend time in.
Someone said just before you got here that you have three deadlines you're working on. Now, we know poaching is one of them.
Yeah.
In 30 or 40 seconds, what are the other two?
I am writing a second Kingdom Keepers series, although it's three books, and it's the same characters. But I refuse to be one of these authors that writes the same book and just puts a different title on it. So it's a very different series. But I've really come to love that, and I know the readers have. And I have a paperback that's sort of in that world that's going to come out around the holidays.
I get the impression you get a little bored maybe with some of your series because the Lou Bolt, I think there were three of them, and then the Sun Valley, three books. Is that correct?
Well, there were nine Lou Bolts, and I would still be writing Lou Bolts, but you have to contend with publishers. And I hope to come back to both the Bolt series and the Sun Valley series.
I enjoyed those.
I'm in negotiations for that.
Ridley Pearson, it's been a delight having you with us once again. Well, I'll remind folks that you'll be at the Barnes & Noble at the Fenton Commons on Gravois tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. Continue the conversation about the latest book just out, The Red Room. Thank you, Ridley. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the future of transportation in the St. Louis region. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.